We talked a lot yesterday about young children. We talked a lot about what to do with our children when they're 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. It's like I'm just thinking of this bread here. You put a bunch of dough in the oven, and something comes out of the other end, and it's pretty good. I'd like to give you, and I know some of the things that she's going to say, and some of the things that they're going to say. I entitled this part, and it was a half-complete item when I did it, so I left some names off. So some people who I had planned to put on here just didn't make it when I sent it off to the printer. And for whatever, I'm sorry about that. Romeo's here. He's on. He will be on. But some people were on. Let me give to you for reactions to what happens when our children grow up. There is life at the end of the at the tunnel. Let me give you to present the next few panelists in this series. Maria Garcia, president of Our Parents of Blind Children.
I see trees.
Hi, everybody. It is a really rare treat for me to.
I see them bloom.
Be from West Side Story.
For me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thank you, Mike. That was sweet. It is a very, very special pleasure for me to get to introduce the next three presenters. I'll be doing that one at a time, though. And first, as a young woman with a great deal of passion and fire, she is, among other things, a committed and inspired educator, and you know how important that is. I'm proud to call her my friend as well. I'd be very proud, in fact, if my own daughter were to grow up to be anything at all like her. Miss Kate Mendez.
Thank you. I said this yesterday, I'm going to say it again. If it isn't obvious, I'm losing my voice. I will talk as loudly as I can. If you guys could, however, for the sake of the people sitting next to you, keep the crashing, banging to a minimum, that would be great. Thank you. The title of this panel is called The Proof of the Puddings in the Living. And we sort of talked before we got up to speak today about the areas of living that we wanted to discuss. And I really wanted to talk today about work and what that's like and what I do and how I got to the point where I can do what I do in the way that I do it. I'm in my third year as a kindergarten teacher in the South Bronx. I teach general ed students at a public school. I want to sort of give you a 10-second overview of what my day is like, although until you've actually sat in a room with somewhere between 20 and 26 5-year-olds, until I did it, what that's like. And then I want to talk about how I learned the skills to be able to deal with that pressure cooker environment as a person who does not see. Let me give you an idea. At 8:10, I run outside into the freezing cold into a yard swarming with children, collect my students, bring them back to the classroom, at which point they bombard me with papers, none of which are, of course, in Braille, book orders, permission slips, notices, anything and everything you could possibly imagine that could come out of a 5-year-old's book bag, up to and including scary stick figure drawings that they did just for me that are overflowing my drawer because I can't bring myself to throw them away. After that, I teach reading. I teach writing. And it's not like it used to be, folks. We definitely do more than ABC. I teach... At this point in the year, I'm doing the alphabet. Later in the year, I will be doing rudimentary spelling. I teach math, which at the kindergarten and lower elementary level involves an awful lot of little pieces of stuff everywhere and little hands putting little pieces of stuff even more everywhere. There is not a gym teacher for the general ed population at the school that I teach at, so I teach PE for my kids once a week, which they should be getting PE more than once a week, but anyway. My kindergarten, now that my school has expanded to a 5th grade, we don't get art in the lower grades, so I teach art. All of these are things that I do as a non-print reading, guide dog using, blind person. Now, there were a lot of people who, when I first started to get this job, who said, no way. Elaine, you finally beat me with numbers of unsuccessful interviews. I thought I was hurting at 15, 14 interviews. 62? Either way, that took the cake. I was feeling pretty, you know, like I'd been through the war and come out the other side after 15. I can't even imagine 62. But I went on 14 or 15 interviews before I could get a job in the New York City Public Schools. And even then, I was only given the job on condition that I had an assistant in the room. Fortunately for me and for my pride and for my sense of self, paraprofessionals in kindergarten classrooms is fairly standard in New York City. So it started off as we'll only hire you if you teach kindergarten and have a para. It has become, thank goodness there's an extra pair of hands to deal with 26 children. Because 26 children who can't tie shoes or zip zippers or button buttons is a lot of people for any, a lot of little buttons and zippers for anybody. So I don't view that having a paraprofessional in the room as an imposition anymore. Not when I see other coworkers of mine have the same, at the same grade level, have the same thing. The reason that I'm able to do the job that I do in the way that I do it, and the reason that I was able to sort of allay the doubts and fears that my principal had when he hired me and that the other principals had when they didn't hire me, was because I had a very strong basis of work from the time that I was old enough to do so. Working as a young adult, working as a teenager, provides you with a tremendous amount of valuable experience that you can bring to bear in whatever job, whether you're doing a job at age 14 that has any bearing on what you're doing when you're 24, 34, 44, etc., is irrelevant. Just being in the workplace makes a big difference. For one thing, working allows you to build up a valuable skill set. I worked one summer at a refugee resettlement program in Syracuse, New York. You don't think of Syracuse as being a place where there's a lot of resettled refugees, but there actually are. And I learned, as a blind person, how to deal with people who I couldn't understand and they couldn't understand me, and they would have papers and documents and things that they needed to know what it was and what it was for, and I couldn't read it, so I couldn't tell them. And I learned to deal with that situation and how to accommodate it. I also improved my Spanish, and when you're refugeeing from the moose? Exactly. No, I don't think so. But when you are, when one third of my student population comes from, are non-Spanish speakers. So when you're also, you know, those skills were tremendously useful in dealing with children who don't speak English and their families. I also worked one summer, and it was the job that I hated the most of all of the summer jobs that I had, but it is ultimately going to be the most useful. Working as an assistant as a grant writer at one of the blindness agencies in the Syracuse area. Let's not go there. But anyway, I did learn a valuable skill of how you get people to give you money. And when you work in the South Bronx and you don't have enough money for books or for paint or for a brand new rug when the one you have is really scary and smelly and old, those are useful skills to have, not just as a blind person, but as anybody. So those were some of the useful things that I acquired when I was younger, when I was working. Working also when you're a kid builds social skills. And I'm not just talking about like being able to eat with your head up and, you know, not be weird, but it also I can't think of a more polite way to put that, but it also helps you to learn to deal with coworkers who don't know what to make of you. So when you walk into a room and you are talking to the person who is supposed to be in that room, because teachers have classrooms and in that classroom is supposed to be that particular teacher, and the teacher who's sitting in the back of the room doesn't say, "Hi, I'm here too," and then all of a sudden you've had this long conversation, you've been in there for 5 minutes, you haven't acknowledged this other person's presence, and finally they pipe up and say something, how do you respond to that? And when you're trying to be a professional in your 20s, it helps to have had that experience when you were 16 and it was okay to be gauche, when you could learn how to respond to not knowing that somebody else was in the room when you were having a conversation. It also helps you learn how to address issues, work-related issues, with grace. What do? I read the way that I'm reading now. I scan my students' books into Kurzweil, put a headphone in my ear, and hold up the book so the kids can see the pictures, and I mark in the Kurzweil where I'm turning pages. What happens when my computer breaks? What do? How do you address that kind of issue? I worked in a preschool for a couple of years when I was in high school, and it allowed me to sort of figure out what to do when that kind of stuff happens. How do you not like freak out and completely shut down? Anybody who knows me knows I'm a very high-stress person, and that my natural reaction is to freak out. You think? And I know that I'm running. I don't want to go talk too long. But also, the work experience that you get when you're in high school and in college allows you to be flexible. Is there anybody in the room that within the last year graduated from a center? Okay, good. No, because if there was, they would have thought that what I'm about to say would put me on their blacklist for all eternity. But I have a little bit of residual vision. I know it's horrible, isn't it? And occasionally I use it because sometimes that's just quicker and easier. And I know there are people that think that people who do that are, you know, in a pact with the devil. However, when your computer breaks, when all of a sudden somebody dumps a paper on your desk that you can't braille and you don't have the resources to handle it right then, being flexible and being able to say, yes, braille is important, but for once it's okay, I can squint at this and sort of figure out at least not everything it says, but enough to do it, deal with it as it needs to be dealt with. You learn to sort of be able to be flexible in the things that you need for accommodations, you absolutely must have, and the things that you can work your way around when they come up. So, and that was an important part of the work experience as a kid. That's pretty much all I have to say, but it really is important, parents, people under 20, if you're still in college or if you're, you know, even if you're getting your master's degree and you're not working at all, it's so important. Find a job, find something, because I wouldn't be where I am if I hadn't done it. And parents, if you have kids that don't want to, drop kick them. Don't give them money. Make them earn it. That's what my parents did. You're 14, you better get a job because we're not buying you. They did buy some, but not to make... My mother said I vilified her yesterday in the parents' meeting, so I have to know. You know. But the understanding was that extra things that I wanted had to come out of my pocket, and that's very important. And you learn also money management from working earlier. So I could go on this theme forever, but there are other people who have other things to say. Do I want... Can I take questions? Do I not need to take questions? What's the agenda here?
Why don't you hold on and take questions from everybody?
All right, good stuff.
I want to get a quick word in, though, because Mindy and I had dinner last night with a couple who's somewhat responsible for your DNA.
Yeah.
I'm told that although she talks about using her braille, and she does use a braille, it wasn't as easy as she made it sound when she acquiesced and said, yeah, sure, Daddy and Mommy, I'll learn braille. I had to beat that child to death almost, I'm told. She did learn in the end. And I, by the way, am a proponent of corporal punishment. It is not the popular PC thing to do with our kids today, but boy, I'll bust them if they weren't doing it right. Anyway, having said all that, I do want to thank Kate. I'm going to put Maria back on for the next person. I do want to thank Kate, but I want to commend Mary Lou and Louise more than thanking Kate. Parents, we have a bond. It's us against them, parents. Mary Lou and Louise, congratulations, sister, brother.
But in retaliation, I will have to say, props for my parents who just this week celebrated their 25th wedding anniversary. Props for the parents.
Your next presenter is a very recent and I think really just delightful addition to the New York State affiliate. She is dynamic and passionate and with a sparkling intellect. She is another example of a young woman I would love my daughter to use as a role model. My favorite word to describe her is effervescent. Chancey Fleet.
Go Bubbles.
Tell her name.
Yeah, go Bubbles. Bubbles Fleet.
Hey, I could get up.
You can call me Alka-Seltzer.
Yeah, the Bubbles is a little too suggestive.
Oh, I like champagne better. Okay, can people hear me? I can never tell. These. Okay. Oh, hi, my name's Chancey Fleet. I am originally from Virginia, and I came here a year and a half ago, and I'm really enjoying it. I work as an adaptive technology specialist, somewhat freelance. My main contract right now is with a company called Integration Technologies, and we do technology training for the federal government, including the IRS, Justice, and a lot of other entities. So I want to talk to you kind of about my path, what brought me to this moment, some of the good things and some of the bad things that happened to me, and kind of give you a 5-minute, 10-minute overview of what my childhood was like that got me here. And I wanted to start out with a quote from Eric Fromm that I found that I thought was kind of cool. The psychic task which a person can and must set for himself is not to feel secure, but to be able to tolerate insecurity. And I think this is what kind of my journey has been about. I've been blessed really by lucky circumstances in my life. I've had good teachers and supportive friends, and I was born in the same decade as the PC, which has really kind of helped out with literacy. But I might be oblivious to all that, rocking in a corner somewhere with a talking book, if I hadn't had the right kind of parents. My father and my mom divorced when I was a little baby, and both of them were and are self-employed. My father is a machinist and industrial designer, and my mom runs an antique store. From the time I entered early intervention, they both came to every single IEP meeting, even though they couldn't get along. They could get along there. And they came prepared to demand intensive Braille instruction and to keep full-time aides, special buses, and other kind of over-accommodations out of my life. But I think the most significant lessons happened to me at home. My father had a cuckoo clock shop for a while, and for Christmas I was given a mahogany clock that's still ticking to this day, and it had bronze Braille numbers so I could learn to tell time. And the cuckoo bird that popped out had little dark glasses like Stevie Wonder ones so I could learn to take a joke.
$10.
It's mine. Now, when I was 5, my mom rented the old housekeeper's cottage on a historical plantation called Ingleside. I learned to walk the quarter mile home from the bus stop on our driveway and to find Queen Anne's lace down by the lake and all kinds of cool things like that. Now, we had a couple of goats and a pony that it was my job to feed every day, and we also had 3 or 4 chickens, and one of my chores was to go get the chicken eggs. These must have been some of the world's tamest chickens because I don't have any childhood memories of being pecked, but I do remember walking back from the coop one day with an egg in each hand and no cane in either one, and 1 minute I was coming across the grass singing a little song to myself, and the next I was into the fish pond. Now, my mom is still telling the story to everyone I ever bring home, but when she tells it, there's nothing about how she should have kept a better eye on me or how that fish pond should have had a higher fence. What she remembers is that when I fell, I did not break either of those eggs. Now, later on, I became a very academic, articulate, technology-loving, socially kind of hopeless high school student with no friends. My parents really tried to fight this, and to this day, I can't come up with an explanation for why it happened. I went away for 8th and 9th grades to a school for the blind so I could learn computer skills. So I think that could have been it. And it could have been the defensiveness about my blindness that came along with being a teenager. And it could have been that kids are inevitably kind of awful at that age. But I convinced myself that I didn't care, and I read a lot of sci-fi books with misunderstood heroes. I always liked aliens. They always made me feel better. And in junior year, I became a founding member of our debate society. By the end of senior year, somehow I had a few very smart, odd little friends and some tournament trophies and an acceptance letter to college. And my first year at William & Mary was pretty much one beautiful, long, humiliating, empowering kind of a wake-up call. And I was determined when I got there to find my place socially. I decided that I would always use my cane from the first day, try to do as much as I could for myself, and own my blindness as a minority status that it was. But I was pretty naive about how to go about all that. My first semester felt like a long episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm. Really awkward. My roommate joined a sorority, and all of her friends sounded like they had been sucking helium every time they said anything to me. Hi, how are you doing? And they didn't talk to me often. I spent the first month taking arms of my friends on the way to the cafeteria, spent the second pretending I wasn't hungry to avoid the embarrassment of asking friends from other dorms to meet me, and finally the third getting lost a lot as I finally decided I'd better learn the campus. One time, a hardcore Christian tried to heal me. Then I discovered the Meridian Coffee House, where we all worked shifts in exchange for nothing but free coffee and rude t-shirts that instructed the reader to stop looking at us. And I felt like I'd found my natural habitat. I found out that I had something called identity politics, and that's something which was really my old outsider status dressed up in cultural criticism suddenly was hot. So it was cool to talk about blindness then. The Meridian is where I learned how to negotiate a crowd at a rock show as a blind person, and that alternative technique, which I have not yet seen referred to in any of the professional literature, can best be described as elbows and hope. While I was in my second semester, each of my parents phoned separately with the same basic message. My father was moving in with his girlfriend, and my mother was renovating the space above her store and would be living there, and they wanted to know what stuff of mine to store and what to throw out, because free room and board was over. I thought about my summer. I didn't have many skills. I'd worked before as a Braille proofreader and for about a week as a counselor, so I got online and called every single school for the blind with a website, and I ended up with 3 applications and one offer to be an elementary teaching assistant all summer in Austin, Texas, and to live on campus in an empty apartment, which I would not have to pay for. The offer was almost rescinded when the vice principal found out that I was blind, which was my first brush with job discrimination. But I talked to her about how I might supervise kids without sight, and then I talked to her about the ADA and what it might mean to her if she didn't hire me. And I managed barely to keep the job. I ended up having it for 2 summers. And I think of the day I flew to Texas with everything I own and a bunch of boxes and suitcases as my first real day as an adult. That was the summer that I learned how to call the bus for routes and actually take the bus, ask for assistance at the grocery store, and finally, at age 18, to warm up a pot pie in the oven. It was a very affirming summer, but also showed me where I was weak, and it started me thinking about how to do better as a blind woman living alone. 3 years later, in 2004, I finally received my independence training at the Colorado Center for the Blind. And that was an important step, but as long as I keep waking up in the morning, there are going to be new situations that will require the invention of new techniques. Now, my family continues to support me. They were more excited than scared when I decided to move from Virginia to Brooklyn, even though I did it with 2 weeks' notice, and my interim destination while I looked for a house was a, quote, international hostel and collective art space that I found online. I had never seen the place before I showed up with my luggage. I had not told the owner I was blind, and she had not told me that her 1860s brownstone had crooked funhouse stairs and a roof deck with no railings, so I guess we were even. Fortunately, we're both adventurous people. I was accepted there at Shabbos dinners and crazy parties because I showed no fear and expected no more hand-holding than any other country cousin moving to the city. After 3 months there, I signed the lease on an apartment with 2 friends from school, and this Christmas, for the first time, I'll be hosting my family at my house. I'm happy. I'm happy. I'm delighted with the way that my life's turning out so far, even though sometimes freelancing is a little starving kind of a time, but usually I'm happy. But I don't take it for granted. Someone could have insisted that I be accompanied by a paraprofessional in the classroom. I could have been asked to attend college somewhere closer to home so I could live at my house with my folks. I could have been allowed to spin around and rock and face the wall while I spoke to people or to talk on and on about my blindness or whatever subjects made me comfortable and pass that off as conversation. If any of that had happened, I would have missed out on employment and independence and fun and friendship and romance, and none of that is what I would want for my life. The way that people felt when Michael Jackson dangled his daughter off a balcony is pretty much how I feel when I see children forced or allowed to trade their futures for an easy life in the present moment. I am terrified of that and outraged, and I just hope the kid doesn't fall. But I've been encouraged this weekend to see so many parents willing to make the better, sometimes more difficult choices for their children, encouraging independence even when it's inconvenient or time-consuming, or not what the professionals have in mind. And I also think how fortunate I've been since 2001 to have found something that I was missing as a child, which is brothers and sisters in blindness. Older and wiser ones to guide me when I'm wavering and to prove by example that the wilderness ahead of me can and should be explored, and younger ones watching me so that I don't ever give in to the lure of complacency or say no to learning something new. And I'm going to close with another quote. This is from Olive Steiner. She was a South African activist in the 20s. I saw a woman sleeping. In her sleep, she dreamt life stood before her and held in each hand a gift. In the one hand, love, and in the other, freedom. And she said to the woman, choose. And the woman waited long, and she said, freedom. And life said, thou hast well chosen. If thou hadst said, love, I would have given thee what thou did ask for, and I would have gone from thee and returned to thee no more. Now the day will come when I shall return, and in that day I shall bear both gifts in one hand. I heard the woman laugh in her sleep. I think there's a lot of love in this room among colleagues and friends and grandparents and parents and kids, and I'm proud to witness that the love that we have here does not shelter or hide us. This love feels like a door hitting each and every one of us right where it counts so we can go out and use our freedom. Thank you.
Good job, great job, Tansy. I do this thing about a door once in a while. Let the door hit us all on the butts on the way out. Browen Evans, Browen, okay. You'll be on soon. I owed somebody time on the agenda. I need to make a couple of announcements before I forget. I'm always prone to forget up here. Neil keeps talking to me. I can't. Yeah, exactly. He's going to sell them. Scholarship committee will meet in room 901 shortly, about 15 minutes after we adjourn. 901. Either Mindy or I will go to the room in time to open it. 901, 15 minutes after adjournment. Nominating committee will meet this evening, 15 minutes after the adjournment of the banquet, in room 505. Nominating committee members are David Steria, chairing, Romeo Edmead, Dennis Halston, Charlie Richardson, Elaine Rink, Lucy Cox, Laura Herman, and Chris Minkler. Room 505, I will make that announcement again later for those of you who forget, which I sometimes do. That's why I did it now. Maria, you're doing it from your seat. I love technology. So, Maria, please introduce the next person to speak to us.
Okay. By way of introduction for your next speaker, I have a very, very short story to tell because I consider him one of the angels in my life and my daughter's. I was on my way to an IEP meeting sometime last year. I was in a very difficult phase fighting with the Department of Education. Was not very hopeful about the meeting. Was feeling particularly defeated. And was driving down 7th Avenue and crossed 14th Street and saw this young man crossing the street and was reminded in this shining moment of all my daughter's future could be. And it was Romeo crossing 14th Street, one of the busiest intersections in the city, you know, moving with grace and beauty through the city. And I was reminded that the Department of Education has no clue of what our kids can do. And he uplifted me in that moment, and we had a great IEP meeting, and I got everything I wanted. So I just wanted to thank him again for that and introduce Romeo Edmead.
All right. I hate to start off any session complaining, but I mean, money, talking books, clocks, and I win makeup. If my friend Ray was here, I promise I would sue. I couldn't have found a place with where something is more backwards than this. The next thing you know, Dick Cheney's going to be like the president of a rifle association. But anyway, thanks for the introduction, Maria. As you guys already heard, my name is Romeo Edmead. Just tell you a little about what I do. I'm a writer. Actually, just got promoted to associate editor for. Thank you. Thank you, thank you. Just got promoted to associate editor of Matilda Ziegler magazine for the blind, which I've been working, I've been there since June of 04, so if my math is right, that's almost 3.5 years. And also, when I want to, when I need a little extra money, work part-time at CBS Sports, where I'm in charge of keeping track of statistics and, you know, keeping track of records during college football games and basketball games and things of that nature. I wanted to talk to you guys today about the difference between skills and attitude. Anytime I have to talk about my childhood parents of blind children or just blind children themselves, I kind of feel guilty. Because when I go around and speak to youngsters who are blind and I ask them, things like, you know, what do you do, like, during the day or when you're home from school or on the weekend in the summertime? And, you know, they say things like, I play piano, I play guitar, I go out with my mother, my father, what have you, we go to the park. And the reason I feel guilty is because I never hear anything like, you know, I go out and I ride my bike, I go roller skating. I get on the train and I go out with my friends and you know, we were able to buy a ball that had a bell in it, so I'm able to play baseball with them. I never hear things like that. And sometimes I get a little bit depressed when I hear that, because I feel like everyone should have an opportunity to do some of the things that I did. as I tell you this, this, of course, you have to keep confidential. You can't tell my mother this, but growing up, I grew up in a building, and fortunately for all of us, they were all boys, and we were all around the same age, and, you know, I did all the run-of-the-mill things that little kids do, like ring doorbells and run. My best friend was a kid who was a lot lighter than me and shorter than me as well. So we used to ride bikes together. It wasn't a tandem bike. One bike, I used to pedal, and he used to steer. And we used to go cruising through traffic and just doing real ridiculous things that all kids do, climbing gates and things of that nature. And riding bikes are, you know, obviously is a skill, but for a blind person, it's more like an attitude. It has a trickle-down effect through the rest of your life. By the time they put a cane in my hand, when I say maybe it was about 9, and just put my back against the wall and said, okay, tap this at this arc, you know, make sure it goes from shoulder to shoulder, and now you just learn two-point touch. That's a skill. But if you don't have the attitude that you could go out there and get from point A to point B, then what good is it? How are you going to get from point A to B if you don't believe that you can do it? I remember thinking to myself when I actually started going out and walking and crossing streets, I remember thinking to myself, like, I ride bikes and roller skate. You mean to tell me I actually can walk? This is easy. I do that without a cane. Yeah, I crashed into some walls. I did. You know, I fell down some steps. I got the scars to prove it. But don't sighted kids do that too? You know, doesn't that happen? Oh, geez. Let's not get into Harold stories. My goodness. Because to be honest, that kind of stuff really doesn't happen every day. Usually when you get hit by trains, you don't make it. But blind youngsters need to understand that you can't just live in a box in your mind and say, well, okay, I learned how to get from my house to the school and back. I learned how to get from the job to the school, from my house to job and back. You want it to be where somebody can call you up and just give you an address, and you just say, okay, well, you know, what train do I have to take to get there? What time you want to meet? And you just go out there and figure it out. You figure it out. The more you travel, the more you do things, you realize almost everywhere you go, you don't know that it'll be there before you get there, but somehow, more often than not, there's almost always a landmark that you can find. And the more you go out there and you step out of that box and you step out of your regular routine, you realize how much you could pick up on things, and it comes to you so easily. I remember I was speaking to a woman on the phone who has a lovely blind daughter. And I just told her some things that have been around forever, probably before I was even born, that she never knew. And there were that the dot is usually on every 5 on the phones, and also the dots on the F and the J of the computer. And she never noticed that. Why? Because she doesn't have to. She doesn't have to. But as blind people, the most subtle difference in something, we'll just be able to tell it. We'll just be able to tell. I want to tell you a couple of quick stories to end it. One really sad, and another one kind of goofy and funny. This past April, I was fortunate enough to be invited to a leadership seminar with Dr. Maurer. And he read us a lot of letters and told us a lot of stories about the history of the Federation. And one story he told us had the room started in complete silence, and then it started to turn. What it was about was a woman who, in the 1980s, had a child, and she was blind herself, the parent. And the city, inexplicably, took the child from this parent. And the child was not, there were no signs of abuse. The child was a very educated child for their age and what have you, and they just took it because they were ignorant. And NFB got involved, fought the case, and the woman eventually lost the case first time. NFB ready to appeal. The woman wrote a letter. Dr. Maurer wrote us the letter. Read us the letter, I should say. And at the end of the letter, it basically said, I've gone as far as I can go. I've done all that I can do. This last couple years was too mentally draining for me. I can't go on anymore. So I appreciate the fact that you would support me on my appeal. But for all intents and purposes, I give up. And the room went from silence to boo-hooing. People crying all over each other. It was one of the most emotional situations I have ever been in, ever. And I've never been in that situation, so I can't say that that woman necessarily had the wrong attitude, because I never walked a mile in her shoes. But if she just had a little bit more, she would have went for that second round. She would have went for the third round if it was necessary. But she had it drummed into her head, apparently, that, you know what, maybe they're right. And that really is a sad mentality. That really is a sad mentality. Now, on the flip side, a real goofy story. Just yesterday, myself and three of my friends who are also blind up here decided, you know what, we want to go out and eat some fast food. We heard there was Popeyes in the neighborhood, supposedly in walking distance. But we're all from the inner city, so to us, walking distance is like right there, right around the corner. We just get on the sidewalk, okay? So we get out there, and we hear a bunch of traffic sound like some highways, and we're looking for the sidewalk. We can't find the sidewalk, just patches of grass, and we're like, oh, what in the world is going on? So we go out there, we're walking along, and all of us, you know, giving our ridiculous opinions. Well, you know, the traffic is coming from this way. I think that means we should go this way. We should have been here by now. Meanwhile, the cars are passing like 6 inches away from us. We could barely hear each other. We're all screaming back to each other. Hey, you there? You there? All right, yeah, I'm here. So eventually we make it to a busy intersection, because that's what the lady at the concierge desk said, you know, front desk, I should say, said that the first busy intersection you get to will be Central Avenue. And there is where all you could find, like, this open mall and get this food or what have you. And we had to cross Central Avenue, and there was nobody on the road, by the way. Nobody walking. We were the only idiots who decided to do this. Only idiots who decided to do this. So eventually, to get directions, I had to walk up to a guy at a red light, stopped in his car, knocked on his window. He rolled it down. I said, is this Central Avenue? He said, yeah. He's like, you know, it's Popeyes and Subway's up this way. He said, yes. So, you know, eventually now we get back to the corner and we're negotiating, because the traffic is like we've never seen before. It's like it's a two-way street, and with one light, some cars could go and the others can't. So it's basically like you have to walk to the middle of the street, stop, wait for the light to change again, and then go again. So we're standing at the corner trying to negotiate. All right, I think it's safe to go. No, it's not. It is. So eventually we get there. We get our food. We make it back home. And when we get here, you know, we start to laugh about it. And it's something that we all kind of turned to each other and said, you know what? The more difficult that got, the more we had to do it. If there are any parents of blind children in this room, or blind children themselves, remember this. Make sure that you always remember the word blind. Make it so that when people say the word blind and they use the word blind 50,000 times in your face and they can't stop using it, and you almost go deaf from the amount of times you hear it, it's because they're saying that you're blind to limitations. You're blind to the word no. You're blind to the fact that you can't do something. and you're blind to the fact that somebody thinks that because you are blind or quote unquote can't see, that, you know, you should be told what to do, when to do it, how to do it, and where to do it. Thank you.
Thank you, Romeo. Laura Herman, can you hear me? Laura, is our future in good hands or what, Laura? Yes. Thank you, Kate, Chancey, Romeo.